Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Events over the past year have shone a light on racial inequality across the globe. Australia is no exception. This nation's journey towards a more just, equitable, and reconciled identity still has a long way to go. With that in mind, and in a spirit of reconciliation, we acknowledge the traditional custodians of country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea, and community. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.
I ask the Prime Minister,
how good is Australia?
Please explain.
Life is changing in Australia
because the pub is shut.
Sucked in, fellas.
I actually find it gobsmacking.
I will call it a personal nightmare.
Tell the Prime Minister to go and get...
It is changing all around the world.
I accept your nomination.
The authority is total.
And I rejected that approach.
It's all about acknowledging how far we've come.
He's all tip and no iceberg.
Like a really scary wooden puppet.
He was drunk.
That's not true.
Not now, not ever.
You're a classic space invader.
A social climbing sycophant. You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Oh, fair shake of the sauce bottle, mate.
In place of democracy, very good.
Do you ever do those nine-letter puzzles in the paper? You've got to make as many four-letter words as you can, and you've got to include the middle letter in the nine-letter grid. I do it sometimes when I should be doing something else. It becomes a habit, looking for anagrams. And I was looking at Ross Garnaut's important new book, Reset, the other day, and it occurred to me that the word reset also makes the word steer and the word trees. Ross Garnaut is a former diplomat and economic advisor to prime ministers. He's also a well-known public intellectual. He's professor of economics at the University of Melbourne. He's been a long-term advocate for climate change. He's the author of countless essays, articles, and reports, probably the most famous of which is the Garnaut Climate Change Review. And his most recent book was Superpower, which charted a way for Australia to lead the world in renewable energy. I'm Mark Kenny from ANU's Australian Studies Institute, and I'm very happy to welcome Professor Garnaut to Democracy Sausage. Ross Garnaut, that's a happy coincidence, is it not, that your latest title, Reset, and those anagrams trees and steer come from that word as well? Because I guess what you're advocating is that we do a fair bit of steering of the economy, and let's face it, we've already got rid of too many trees, as you've pointed out before, and we need to stop doing that as well.
Oh, not only stop getting rid of trees, an important theme of the book, a chapter, is about how much economic activity we can develop becoming a repository of carbon for the world through utilising our opportunity to grow biomass and capture carbon in the landscape. It's even better than you're suggesting. It's also steer and the castration of Australia by taking away opportunity for growth is also one of the possibilities, because the book's about the choice we'll make about after the pandemic, about whether we restore Australia on full employment and rising incomes or go back to the dog days, 2013 to 19.
Yes, we'll go to the actual formal title of the book with its subtitle as well. It's called Reset, Restoring Australia After the Pandemic Recession. And so we'll go to those issues of the dog days between, which you say are between really the GFC in 08, 09 and this pandemic and underperformance during that time. But let me first kick off with just a couple of opening thoughts, because you've written this about this moment that Australia has. I guess the world has it. It's the nature of a global pandemic, but Australia certainly has it in terms of a whole lot of policy settings. Two opening thoughts about the pandemic. It's ongoing and could yet return to our shores in a serious way. That remains a threat. But the other one that's interesting is that we are already out of technical recession. You know, there was a lot of warning about how bad this was going to be. It seemed sort of apocalyptic almost at points, particularly if you're living in Melbourne through a good deal of 2020. And yet We've seen the economy bounce back, at least on the figures. We've seen employment growth quite strong, and we've seen, you know, things like housing prices rocketing. And there's a real sense that the recession for the economy was short and sharp, and it's already over.
Well, we did have a recession, first time we've had one for 28 years. And it was a deep one, sharp and deep. In the first half of last year, we had a very large decline in economic output and employment, the first recession since the recession of 91. So it was real. The government, in my view, appropriately, spent $250 billion on debt-funded government expenditure and tax cuts. And you can't spend that much funded by debt without getting a very strong response. And we've got the appropriate response. We've got the quick movement out of recession that that John Maynard Keynes in 1936 told us to expect.
Yes, well, that's right. We saw everyone become Keynesians really for a period of time, and I guess will remain so for a while because, as you say, the economy's been propped up by a great deal of public spending. Nonetheless, even though it was a sharp and, as you say, deep recession, it was one that was imposed by sort of exogenous factors rather than deep structural problems within the economy. This was a pandemic that came along and forced a shutdown of a whole lot of commercial activity. Is that one of the other reasons why we've then been able to come out of it quickly?
I'm not sure that that's the main reason, Mark. I think we, without that very strong stimulatory action, I think we would have been experiencing very high unemployment and, in my view, we've still got high unemployment, but even much higher unemployment and lower output, even in the circumstances we were in, if we hadn't had that very big stimulus. The very strong government action, JobKeeper, JobSeeker, other payments programs, all gave a very big boost to economic activity. And they're the reasons we bounced out quickly. A lot of other countries have bounced out quickly because they did very similar things. China, even bigger than us as a proportion of the economy, so they've had even stronger growth than us. The US now, with Biden, doing it bigger and more strongly than us as a proportion of the economy. So the US will have very strong growth this year. Keynesian policies work in the circumstances in which Keynes advocated them. Very big budget deficits funded by Reserve Bank creation of money can give you a very strong growth in output and employment. That's why we came quickly out of recession.
Yes, okay. Well, so, but nonetheless, even though we've come out of that recession, we've still got that debt, and we can talk about that a bit later. But it interests me the role that the Reserve Banks played in this as well. We've seen interest rates go down. They've been at record lows now for some time. We're dealing with interest rates these days that seem to be permanently in this, or more or less permanently. We've had Philip Lowe, the governor of the Reserve Bank, indicate that he doesn't expect interest rates to start moving for a scale of years, a couple of years, maybe 2024, before we see interest rates going back up. So what's your assessment of whether the Reserve Bank acted first quickly enough, and also whether that prediction of interest rates staying where they are is going to hold?
We've got very low global interest rates, certainly right through the developed world, at the moment, and have had for some time, for deep structural reasons. Through the 21st century, around the world, people have been saving a higher proportion of their incomes, and business has been tending to invest a lower proportion of total expenditure. So we've been moving towards an excess of savings in the global economy. And that gives you low long-term interest rates in markets. We were slower. Our Reserve Bank was slower to react to that reality than other central banks. And that's one reason why we perform very poorly in what I call the dog days, between the China resources boom, which ended about 2012, 2013, and the pandemic in 2020. During those 7 years, the dog days, Australia had the lowest growth in output per person of the developed countries, lower even than Japan, which we think of as a poor performer. We had stagnant real household income per person, very unusual over a seven-year period. In fact, if we had comparable data, it might be unprecedented since white settlement. At the same time, stagnant unemployment stuck 5 point something, which I think is still high unemployment. And I contrast that in the book with what happened in the US, which started in 2013 with unemployment 2 or 3 percentage points higher than Australia, and ended the period with unemployment a couple of percentage points lower, right down to 3.5%. We perform poorly on unemployment, and even worse on underemployment through those periods. Through that period, those 7 years, underemployment, people not being able to work as many hours as they wanted to, although they were classified as employed, underemployment grew and grew through that period. So it was a pretty bad period, and I present data comparing what happened in Australia with the US and attribute a substantial part of that unemployment being stuck at 5 point something, to Australia running tighter monetary policy than other developed countries. I think that was a mistake. And the really good news is that in response to the pandemic recession, no doubt to some of the critique of earlier policy, the Reserve Bank has got much closer now to the monetary policies being followed in other developed countries. We're not an outlier the way that we were. We've still got tighter monetary policy than the average for developed countries. We've still got positive interest rates, cash rates, and rates out the first few years of the curve, when half of the GDP in developed countries is in countries with negative interest rates. We've now joined the rest of the world in what's called quantitative easing, funding government debt through the Reserve Bank purchase of government securities, in effect creating money. That all helps us to get back in line with other developed countries. If we stay in line with other developed countries, we'll have taken away one of the barriers to getting to genuine full employment.
What's your explanation for why we were running that tighter monetary policy through that period? Is it just simple kind of conservatism? Was it resting on our laurels to some extent as we, you know, you made the point before about how we had our first recession after 28 years of unbroken growth. So that became part of the kind of almost political, you know, folklore of the country that we were an economic success story. Do you think we were just aiming too low and that we should have been, our policymakers, both government and the Reserve Bank, should have been aiming for to eat further into that pool of unemployed and underemployed, be a bit more adventurous?
We were certainly aiming too low. We stopped even talking about full employment. The Reserve Bank Act, which was drawn up in the recent memory of the Great Depression, in a series of stages under Chifley and Menzies, that put full employment as the central objective of the Reserve Bank. The words full employment don't appear in the monthly statements on monetary policy all the way through the dog days until the end of 2019. Yeah, not a mention of it. Now, since the onset of the pandemic, most monthly statements after the monthly board meetings of the Reserve Bank mention the words full employment. That's a welcome readjustment of ambition. We were complacent. 28 years of continuous economic growth led all parts of our society, our political leadership, but the community and our important economic institutions like the Reserve Bank to think we were doing okay. But when you look closely, that 28 years breaks down into three periods, three rather unequal periods. The first decade, what I call the productivity boom in the book, was a period where growth in incomes was spurred by rising productivity. In the book, I talk about the period from about 2002 to 2012 having rising incomes per person, increasing prosperity being driven by the China resources boom. I call that period the China resources boom. After 2012, in the period 2010-2019, our growth came mainly from expanding population, a majority of it from immigration, and with less and less focus on really genuinely immigration of people with high value in the labour markets, more temporary migration, less permanent migration. That gave us growth in total output without any growth in living standards for Australians. And that's why I call that period the dog days. We had 28 years of unbroken economic growth, a marvellous achievement. Recessions do great damage, and it was a huge achievement to avoid it. But we kidded ourselves that we were still doing pretty well when, in fact, we were no longer doing as well as other developed countries on the measures that really matter for the community.
And it's interesting that you mention immigration, and you also mentioned the China resources boom. China's obviously been a key aspect of Australia's economic success right through this period, if not as acutely as it was in that period up to sort of around 2012. But the pandemic, of course, has come along as well, and we've essentially stopped that immigration. We've had our border closed for the last 12 months, a bit longer. It just strikes me that that's a kind of a double whammy, isn't it? We seem to be doing fine at the moment, but we don't have that immigration, and we don't have a deteriorating bilateral relationship with China. I think you're a former ambassador to Beijing many years ago. In fact, I remember you telling the press club once that you hit a six onto the roof of the Temple of Heaven, which is a pretty damn good story in itself. Feel free to tell us about that. But is it right that we've sort of got both these engines or drivers of growth, China and immigration, are both in a slightly perilous state at the moment?
Well, you've asked me, you invited me to comment on the six. Well, it wasn't me. We had a lanky West Indian batting number 11 for Australia. We had a very active, vigorous cricket league, we used to call it the World League, in Beijing, and we were allowed by the authorities to use the cricket, well, it wasn't a cricket ground, an open space alongside the Temple of Heaven. We were very successful in recruiting people who knew how to swing a bat and throw a ball from the Commonwealth countries that didn't have big enough embassies to run a cricket team.
Right.
So we had this big West Indian, and he hoved a big pull onto the roof of the Temple of Heaven, and the Chinese authorities didn't see the humour in it, and they banned us from that. And so from then on, we were playing in a muddy field on the edge of Beijing. But we do face some headwinds now. Certainly, the change in immigration means that for these couple of years, we're not going to get growth from immigration and growing population. I think that's a big and good opportunity to reset immigration policy, to think again what we want to get out of that. I say in the book that I think that we made a mistake in shifting from the successful historical pattern of immigration to Australia after the Second World War, really until the end of the 20th century, where we focused on permanent migration. And we shifted the focus to temporary migration. It began in 1996 with the 457 visas, and was extended to a lot of other categories of temporary migrants until
about. Yeah, that's the skilled migrant visa, right? The 457?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Temporary migrants.
Yeah.
And went away from that old pattern of immigrants to Australia being on a path to citizenship, and when we used to invest in their settling in as Australians, becoming part of Australian institutions, learning the language because they were going to be here forever. I think that the shift to temporary migration was associated in practice with a shift away from economically valuable skills. It wasn't the intention. It certainly wasn't, well, it may not have been the intention. It certainly wasn't how the policy was articulated, but it's what happened in practice.
So is that the decline of manufacturing, do you mean? Would that be an archetype of what you're saying, the decline of manufacturing industries here? We weren't bringing in people to skilled people to do those sorts of jobs?
No, I don't think it's particularly related to that, but a whole lot of jobs that used to be done by relatively low-skilled Australians, sometimes young Australians, while they were accumulating other skills, came to be performed by temporary migrants. Couples came to expect that they'd be able to employ au pairs from overseas at very low rates to look after their kids. Rural employment became the preserve overwhelmingly of temporary migrants, so that the unskilled labour force of rural Australia was left out. Business in Australia lost its interest in and capacity to impart skills to young Australians. So I think that was a mistake. And I think the cessation of migration for a year or two gives us a chance to rethink that. I'm suggesting we go back to moderate levels of immigration, the sort of levels we had in the 90s, adding about 0.5% per annum to our population. That still gives us far higher immigration as a share of the existing population than other developed countries, almost all other developed countries. That shift and a shift back to emphasis on permanent migration and skills, I think will help Australia get to full employment with rising incomes.
Let's take a quick break there and be back in one moment.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Sharon Bessel. Policy Forum Pod is the podcast for those who want to dig a little deeper into the policy challenges facing Australia and its region. Each week, we bring together expert analysis to tackle the big issues facing our region and to propose policy solutions. It's insightful, it's positive, and it's always fun. Policy Forum Pod is out every Friday. You can find it on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Or find us at policyforum.net/podcasts.
Welcome back. Now, I took a break then, Ross, when you were halfway through answering a two-part question. You were about to address the China side of it, so away you go.
Yes. I mentioned that if we're going to have rising incomes and full employment through the 2020s, so we're going to have quite strong growth in what I call trade-exposed industries, especially the export industries. We face some pretty big headwinds there, as you mentioned, Mark. A lot of our export growth has come from exports to China in the last 3 decades, especially the last 2 decades. China now accounts for the value of exports, or in 2019, it accounted for the value of exports of our next 9 trading partners. If you count Hong Kong as part of China, it's as much as the next 11. And that's not the result of governments pushing it in that direction or business overlooking other opportunities. Government, from time to time, put special efforts into developing non-China alternatives. Huge effort at the time of the Australia-US Free Trade Agreement. Earlier on, I remember the Hawke government put a lot of effort into trade expansion with India, with Japan, with Korea. It's just that the structure of the Chinese economy created lots more opportunity. Now, we do face several headwinds to our exports. We're going to need stronger growth in exports than in the total economy if we're going to have rising incomes. But there are big headwinds against that. One is the problem in relations with China. That's not going to go away easily. And I sort of take some of the current problems as part of what we have to live with for the time being. I do point out that China's growth is very good for Australian trade and Australian prosperity, even if we're not getting access, direct access to the Chinese market on as good a terms as Europeans or Americans or New Zealanders or other or Asians. We won't get some of the high-value trade, some of the high-margins trade, but we still benefit from strong growth in China because China importing more beef from America, more lamb from New Zealand, more oilseeds from Southeast Asia, more food of all kinds from Europe, raises the price of food in those countries. And so makes us more competitive against them, against New Zealand, more competitive in the Australian market because the price of lamb rises in New Zealand. So we shouldn't see the problems in the bilateral relationship as making the growth of China irrelevant to our exports. We can still get a lot of benefit even if we're cut out of some of the high-value direct trade. But the other head, but it's still a headwind. We've got to recognise it's not as things are not as good as they would be if we had direct access as in the past. For other areas of trade, 22% of our exports in 2019 were fossil energy, coal and gas. Fossil energy will not be growing in the period ahead because of the commitment of the rest of the world to moving towards zero emissions. So we've got to get our growth from elsewhere. Pandemic recession during the dog days, the most dynamic part of our exports and the third largest export industry in the late teens was education services and the fracturing of the financial base of the universities through the pandemic with the failure to provide emergency support from JobKeeper and in the other ways that other service industries like casinos were given will mean that it will be a long time before the universities can contribute anything like the elements of growth that they were contributing before the recession. So they're very big headwinds. A couple of the later chapters in the book talk about alternative avenues that can help us overcome those headwinds.
Well, let's just stick with what you said about universities for a moment, though. And you're speaking to me from University of Melbourne. I'm from ANU. We have it out on the table that we could be accused of talking our own book here a bit. But, we've often heard this term, the clever country. We've been well aware of the idea of first world economies being, playing to their strengths with, world-class education systems and the like. As you say, it's been our third largest export earner. Higher education services, third or fourth, it's sort of bumped around in there. It's extremely important. And yet there was a decision taken right at the start of the government assistance, which you, quite rightly lauded in terms of its Keynesian impact on the economy in a whole range of sectors. But higher education was specifically carved out of that. There was, to be fair, a $1 billion grants program that came to universities. But it's a major employer. It's a major driver of export income, and it's a major driver of the long-term economic prospects of this country. I guess two questions. Why do you think that it was the university sector was excluded? And two, has the government condemned us to a kind of an economic version of long COVID as a result of the damage done to universities?
Yeah, well, I don't know why it was excluded. It does seem anomalous. But I'd say in defence of the government that they had to put together these packages very quickly and it's inevitable, I suppose, that there'll be mistakes. There were other mistakes. Allowing JobKeeper to be allocated to companies who said they were going to have big losses of revenue and then not having a mechanism for clawing it back if they didn't have those losses is one mistake. The exclusion of the university, I think, is a really big mistake. But all those decisions had to be made very quickly. And in the nature of things, there wasn't time for the usual assessment and discussion. So the important thing is that the government faces up to mistakes and corrects them so that they don't become permanent manacles on around the legs of the Australian economy.
But that's what actually has happened, is it not? I mean, there was plenty of commentary around at the time about it, so it wasn't like they didn't have real-time feedback about the design of the package from the beginning. Now, okay, they make a decision about that, but there have been, I think, 21,000 job losses. It's really been huge.
And it's been huge, and the effects will go far beyond just the macroeconomic impact of all that employment and income. I point out in the book that that Australia's standing in the international education community is extraordinarily high for our population. We've got six of the top 100 universities as rated in the normal quality rankings. China has two. Canada has much less than us. Very few European countries, including those with much bigger populations, have anything like us. We stand out for quality, and that's been an enormous source of advantage for us. It means that the children of the leaders of Asia have looked to Australia for education of their children. Whether we're talking about the business elites, the bureaucratic elites, the political elites, or the intellectual elites, Australia's been very highly regarded. We're up there, not all that different in size as a market for education for Asian students from the UK and US, one of the big three in the world. And the standing of our universities, our rankings have been very important to that. People sometimes criticise the rankings. Sure, they are a bit arbitrary, but they're real in terms of perceptions. And that's given us a lot of influence. Well, if we don't correct the mistakes that were made, and I don't want to presume to understand the reasoning, but if we don't correct whatever the reasoning was, then we're going to put ourselves at a disadvantage in relations with the rest of Asia at a time when soft power competition with China is particularly acute. But also it weakens a lot of our other export capacity. I mentioned how one of the responses of the universities to the fracture of the business models of the universities, the financial difficulties, has been to cut back on geosciences. Well, that was one of the areas where we were top of the world, and we've cut back dramatically. And it was our strength in that area that caused us to be the place that trained the leaders in geology, geosciences, geophysics, a lot of the disciplines that are crucial to successful mining industry and mining company, and are going to be very important in the zero emissions world economy. So from a lot of points of view, unless we correct that error, we'll pay a very high economic price.
Now, I guess the whole logic of your book, Reset, is that, you know, this is this pandemic crisis is an opportunity really to revisit a range of these key areas of our political economy and make changes. Is this an economist's version of the political axiom, never waste a crisis? Is that essentially what you're saying, that we have this moment and we've been forced to sit back and look at some of these settings and now's the chance to do those things?
Yes, I think it is. It is an opportunity to reset, to reflect on our underperformance in the years before the pandemic recession, reflect on why we had lower output, lower growth in output per person, even than Japan, and much lower than the United States or the average for the OECD. reflect on why we were satisfied with 5-point-something% unemployment when the U.S. was down to 3.5 without inflation, to reflect on why we were satisfied with underemployment rising and rising. It's also an opportunity to reset fiscal and monetary policies. We've already talked about the monetary policy, and alongside that, there's been a very substantial reset of fiscal policy. The breaking of the shibboleths of the period after the global financial crisis that was so critical of the fiscal policies that caused us to avoid a recession, and then by pulling back on government expenditure too fast, pulling back on deficits too fast, meant that we had an additional drag on employment growth on top of the primary cause of underperformance, monetary policy. It's a time to fundamentally re-examine fiscal and monetary policy, and I suggest in the book a big corporate tax reform that would shift the balance of the taxation burden away from companies that are investing and innovating towards companies that are sitting on their laurels. And
Let's go to that then, because that's a really interesting one, and I want to go to the full employment question as well, but just go to this change in the corporate tax model that you're advocating. You're saying that we should tax cash flow rather than taxing activity, or what was it, revenue before?
Well, we're taxing accounting profits before.
Yes.
That was the old definition of profit. And it's the way we've done corporate tax pretty well from the beginning. But it's got a number of unsatisfactory features, and the unsatisfactory features have grown more and more as it's become harder to actually pin down the place in which companies earn their profits. Lots of advantages in this economy from being a foreign enterprise that can avoid or evade Australian taxation by generating income in nominally in tax havens, which aren't taxed. And then that induces Australian companies to restructure themselves. So a lot of their income goes to tax havens. The biggest element of the change is the immediate deductibility of all capital expenditure and the offsetting of negative cash flows with a payment equal to the tax rate, which would be a very powerful incentive to investment and innovation. That's balanced in its effect on the revenue by the denial of interest payments and other financing payments as a tax deduction, and also denial of deductions for imported services, unless it can be shown that the taxpayer, or that the imports involved costs that were undertaken on behalf of producing these services for the taxpayer. All of that those changes would have the effect of substantially shoring up the corporate tax base against opportunities for evasion and avoidance, and also shift the burden away from companies that are innovating, investing, and contributing to future productivity growth.
Yeah, so you describe a lot of taxation, or you're proposing to make a change that would actually shift that burden towards companies that are actually, you know, sort of living off earnings of established assets. So essentially, yes, Economic rent, as you call it.
Yeah, that's right. And I've got a lot of detail about how that would work in the book. It's based on work that I've done with colleagues over a number of years, some of it published in the Australian Economic Review and elsewhere. And I've got a chapter in the book explaining how that would all work and why it would be so helpful to the economy that we want to build in future.
Now, can we go to this question of full employment? You've mentioned it a few times. It's obvious one of the key levers you think we should change in this. In this, you mentioned in the book one of the key resets. There is talk now of what constitutes full employment, and I suppose that's the threshold question, because I think a lot of us were told over a period of time that essentially full employment was somewhere around 5%, perhaps 4.5%. There's a bit of rethinking going on about that now. As you say, the US prior to the pandemic was at 3.5% unemployment. Do you think that's what we ought to be shooting for, that kind of low level of unemployment with a 3 in front of it?
I think we should be recognising we won't have full employment until the labour market is so tight that wages are rising quite strongly in the labour market, and that is generating inflation at a rate that threatens to take us above the 2.3%, 2 to 3% target range for inflation on a sustainable basis. That's where the U.S. Federal Reserve has gone. Powell, the chair of the Board of Governors, has said that because the U.S. undershot its inflation target for a lot of years, it should overshoot for enough years to mean that on average they've kept to it.
That's an interesting idea. We've been undershooting as well, of course. I mean, we're not in the 2.2 to 3% range either. And you mentioned before that we don't have full employment mentioned in a lot of those Reserve Bank decisions, but we always have that inflation target mentioned because that's been the driver of monetary policy. So even the language, I think, needs to change in emphasis, doesn't it?
It does. And the really good news, Mark, is that it has changed. There's been, in the last year and a half, there's been historic change in the stance of monetary policy. As I mentioned before, the monthly statements that the governor makes after board meetings on monetary policy now mostly include reference to full employment. They didn't. Yeah. From the beginning of 2013 until nearly the end of 2019.
And he's even made sort of comments about at various times, some of them reasonably oblique, but sort of entreating workers to get a bit more bolshy, a bit more militant, and to demand higher wages. I mean, they've been – so the banks gradually come to recognise that this stubbornly flat wages growth situation we've had needs to change, but with 5.5%
unemployment. Yes, and the main institution for doing something about that was the Reserve Bank. Workers can be as bolshy as they like, but they won't get wage increases unless the labour market's tight. Yeah. Supply and demand works, economics based on some premises that are as true now as they ever were. The definition of full employment should be the level of unemployment at which inflation is threatening to take off and accelerate at a rate that takes us sustainably above the 2 to 3% range. Now, the Reserve Bank's language is getting close to that, very different from before. This is an historic change. It's supported by a historic change in approach to what's called quantitative easing, the central bank's purchase of government securities, in effect funding Commonwealth and state debt, preventing increased Commonwealth and state debt leading to higher interest rates in the market. We still haven't gone all the way to the average of other developed countries, but the change that's occurred is an historic change. And I said in an opinion piece in the AFR last week that the change has been so big that if we don't get back to full employment and rising incomes, and if the Reserve Bank stays where it is on monetary policy, then the Reserve Bank won't be the main cause of underperformance in the years ahead.
Did we get too frightened about the idea of wage inflation? Because it used to be a real bogey when it was talked about. If we think back into the 80s and 90s, there was a lot of sort of concern that wage inflation was threatening to get out of control. But we had a much more unionized workforce than we do now. Are those two periods strictly analogous? Is there a lower level of militancy and industrialization in our labor force likely to mean that that threat isn't quite as dire as it might have once been perceived as?
Well, certainly the change in the structure of the labour market, much lower levels of unionisation, changed the nature of inflationary pressures in the labour market. But the big difference is that we ran much higher tendencies towards excess demand through the 70s and early 80s, and it took a long time to break the inflationary expectations that came with that. Inflation was a real worry and had to be dealt with, but it hasn't been the main concern in the last quarter of a century. But we've continued to set up all of our monetary policy guns to fight inflation when the real enemy was something else, was unemployment.
Yeah. Now, we haven't got too much time left, but I do want to go to another one of your key levers in there, and one that I think a lot of people are very interested in. Among your most dramatic suggestions is a version of what many people call a universal basic income. Now, in some senses, we arguably already have that in the sense that we have unemployment benefits and other income support for people unable to participate in the labour market. And of course, we have a tax-free threshold, which means that you don't pay any income tax up to, I think it's $18,200, and then slightly less than a dollar out of every five for any income earned after that until about $45,000. So could you just talk to what it is that you're proposing and what's kind of how it goes beyond that?
Yes, I'm proposing the integration of the tax and the social security systems, and it could be called a basic income tax. It could be called a negative income tax. Both of those terms have a bit of political colour in them. The negative income tax, of course, was proposed by the Freedmans and was seen as highly beneficial by the right wing of the economic policy debate, the basic income tax favoured by those who have a more social democratic view of what's appropriate in economic policy, and therefore people who have a stronger emphasis on government intervention to create greater equity. The concept has no political colour. It's just a more efficient way of achieving everyone's objectives. And it's built around the idea of paying everyone, all Australians, except those on high incomes and high wealth, and I talk about what those levels might be, a basic income into their bank account every fortnight, and then taxing income from the first dollar. There's no tax-free threshold, but at a moderate rate. And I talk about two possibilities, 37% or 32.5%. In that way, we remove disincentives for people to go from part-time to full-time employment, very powerful disincentives that have discouraged especially second earners from full participation in the labour force. I think that removing that will be very important at full employment. Might not matter much to economic performance if you've still got a lot of unemployment, but at full employment it'll be crucial, make the economy bigger to get rid of those disincentives, and so it will to a significant extent pay for itself. The other benefit is that it becomes a supplement to wages for people on low incomes and means that you don't have to secure equity through increased wages instead of Bolshevik unionists demanding more, they'll get more through these fiscal processes, and there'll be less disincentive for employers taking on low-skill workers, and so expand employment growth. It will be costly to begin with. Those costs will fall over time as we get closer to full employment. And more people are employed as a result of the reform. My assessment is that by the time we've got full employment, the costs of this measure will be smaller as a proportion of the economy than the costs of introducing John Howard's GST, where a lot more revenue was given out to the states to households as income tax cuts than was collected by the GST.
Now, just got a couple of very quick questions to ask you. One of them is just about the nature of the debate. Now, you've proposed a whole series of really innovative ideas here. You've done a lot of work. You've been around the public policy debate all of your life. How do you rate the state of intellectual life in Australia, of what you might call public discourse around ideas? Is it frustrating for you to be doing this kind of work, to be pumping these ideas into the system and not see them sort of seriously engaged with by the political class?
Oh, I don't think that any important ideas are readily accepted by everyone without a lot of discussion. You might remember, Mark, I was writing and talking about the advantages of reducing tariffs, of free trade, a couple of decades before Bob Hawke did it.
It takes time.
I know that these things don't necessarily come easily. And I think that a necessary condition for good policy in a democratic polity like ours is that people are putting the ideas out and discussing them. And another necessary condition is that you have leaders who can pick them up and run with them. We don't have that, obviously, at the moment, but sometimes you can be surprised. And sometimes when the conditions are right, leaders will pick up ideas that are in the public interest and run a long way with them. We can point to a lot of examples of that. We do know that reform in the public interest is hard, that we also know in our democratic polity it's possible. It's possible when good ideas have been thoroughly discussed in the public arena. It's possible when you have leaders who are prepared to put the public interest above partisan and sectoral interests and take a long-term view. And it will only work for them if they're prepared to put a lot of effort into public education themselves. And it will only work if the ideas as a whole are seen broadly in the community as being fair. Those elements have been there in our earlier periods of successful reform. They may be there in the year ahead. I certainly don't rule it out, and I'm looking forward to seeing how the discussion unfolds.
So just keep plugging away. Final question, and it's just a sort of a short thing, I suppose. But I had Graham Smith and Yun Zhang on the podcast not so long ago, both China experts, and we were talking about issues around the problems with the bilateral relationship and the like. I asked them at the end of that discussion what state they felt the relationship would be in 12 months from now. Both of them said they thought it would deteriorate. I wonder what your answer to that question is.
I don't see any immediate fundamental improvement. It may be at the moment things are particularly bad, so you are a real pessimist if you think they're going to get worse than that. In the US-China relations are showing some complexity now, with the Biden administration being prepared to work constructively with China on issues where both sides recognize there's a common interest, and for there to be confrontation on other issues. To get that sort of nuance into our relationship with China would be a step forward, and I think that's not beyond possibility.
Ross Garnaut, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us on Democracy Sausage. Your book is called Reset: Restoring Australia After the Pandemic Recession. It's available from La Trobe, and it's well worth a read. There's some just a treasure trove of terrific ideas in there, and very well argued they are too. So thanks so much for giving us your time.
And lots of ideas there about how grasping the zero emissions opportunity can help us to get to a good place.
Yes, we probably should have spoken a bit more about that, perhaps another time. Anyway, that is Democracy Sausage for now. Thank you for listening. Until next time, which will probably be Friday this week when it'll come out rather than Thursday. And don't forget our Twitter handle if you want to get to us. It's at APPS Policy Forum. That's at APPS Policy Forum. The email is podcast@policyforum.net. And you can get us on Facebook as well if you type Policy Forum Pod into the search bar. So until the end of the week, bye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.